we are suckers to help countries stabilize themselves after a civil war and after a conflict. George Marshall would be turning over in his grave to hear that. That really is a refutation of what has been a successful American strategy for the last 70 years. And the third thing that's wrong with the president's approach to writing off Syria is you would think, listening to him, that we were the only country involved in trying to defeat ISIS, when in fact there are a coalition of 74 countries contributing in one way or another. And the president in no way acknowledged or appreciated the contributions that others are making to share this burden and to fight alongside us. All three of those are really big strategic errors.
The big question when we learned that the president had gone to Iraq was he going to make an announcement and say the U.S. is going to pull its troops out of Iraq as well? He did not say that. He says he wants to keep them there. What are those troops in Iraq doing, and what do you think the president's calculus is in Iraq?
American troops in Iraq, alongside our NATO allies and other countries, are helping to train and support Iraqi troops who are fighting ISIS, stabilizing the country, establishing the rule of law, helping assist NGOs and other reconstruction efforts in places where ISIS ravaged the country. And in northern Iraq, in the Kurdish areas, President Trump's decision to write off Kurdish militia who have been helping fight ISIS alongside us is really destabilizing. And not just in Syria, but also in the domestic politics in Turkey and in the domestic politics in Iraq. President Trump's announcement that, you know, Turkey said they're going to take care of this is not a reassuring prospect for Kurds in Turkey, in Syria, in northern Iraq, or in Iran,
who have their own internal conflicts. At the same time, ISIS is severely weakened, but they are still active. The group claimed responsibility for a car bomb attack in northern Iraq on Christmas Day. Do you think there's a risk that ISIS will regroup if the U.S. military doesn't have a presence in the region, or has less of a presence in the region?
Yes, I do. We saw that happen with Al-Qaeda in Iraq. We saw it happen with the rise of ISIS in Iraq and in Syria. So the lesson of the last 17 years ought to be, if you do not help improve the rule of law, governance, and security in countries that have been ravaged by terrorism or civil war, you are allowing the regrouping, planning, and carrying out of additional violence by those groups.
Now, this is all happening while the president's Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, is resigning. He'll be out in a couple of days. Here's what the president had to say about the search for a replacement for Mattis.
Everybody wants that position. Everybody. Everybody. So many people want to be. Who wouldn't want to be Secretary of Defense?
Okay, so let me put that question the president poses to you. Who wouldn't want to be Secretary of Defense?
Well, Jim Mattis, evidently. I think one of the reasons that the president is trying to put so much top spin on the ball and suggest that everyone's clamoring into his administration is that his personnel choices and his policy choices over the last 2 years have driven out or forced out people who are voices of sensibility and restraint, and surrounded the president by people who will echo and cheer his reckless choices. And if you just look at the way the president yesterday, talking to American troops in Iraq, violated longstanding norms of civil military discourse by having a political rally, talking about blaming the Democrats for the shutdown. That's a very bad way to politicize the role of the American military.
Corey Shockey, Deputy Director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
2 months ago today, a gunman opened fire at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. 11 worshipers were killed in that attack. The gunman is now facing 29 federal charges. He allegedly chose the synagogue as a target because it supported a program sponsored by a Jewish aid group to resettle refugees in America. NPR's Jerome Sokolowski visited another congregation in Falls Church, Virginia, which sponsors a Muslim refugee from Iraq.
Temple Road of Shalom is one of dozens of Jewish congregations across the country that have been helping to resettle refugees. 3 years ago, its members agreed to sponsor a single mother who fled northern Iraq with her children and was originally brought to America by a Christian charity. Tilko asks not to be identified by her full name because she fears for her safety. She says that back in Iraq, she didn't know much about Jews.
Whatever little I heard was all negative. Jews kill others just for no reason. They are bad, they're mean, they are not helpful.
And then she met the Jews who had volunteered to help her begin a new life in America.
I was just taken back for a second. I was like, wow. Like the way they greeted me with the love and the respect, the way they just embraced me.
And it was so unexpected that it wiped away all her preconceptions.
I realized it was all lies, what they've said about Jews.
Over the holidays, Tilko got together with congregation members who helped her rent an apartment, get a green card, and find a job. For Jews across America volunteering in this way, it's about following the injunction in the Torah to love the stranger as yourself. Certainly no one at Road of Shalom thought of it as controversial, let alone dangerous. But then, on October 27th, a gunman walked into the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh and killed 11 people. That congregation supported the Jewish aid group Pious, which resettles people fleeing Syria and other trouble spots. And the shooting suspect said that's why he targeted the synagogue.
That statement really hurt.
Volunteer Susan Levy.
Because that's exactly the kind of work that we've been doing. And of course, we help Muslims because we help those who need help. And that's really what it is, no matter what background they come with. Everybody that comes to America deserves the same opportunities that our ancestors had.
Levy says America welcomed her own grandmother when she fled pogroms in Russia. So she helped Tilko get settled here by accompanying her to job interviews.
I have a background in HR, so I knew the language to speak.
The volunteers cheering on Tilko's children at a game were not so long ago helping them with their homework. 15-year-old Yahya says it made all the difference at school.
When we came here first, our math was very bad and they helped us. Now we have A on math. And our grades are very good.
Someone who helped the family with school paperwork is Helene Lederer. To her, aiding the stranger is a fundamental part of being Jewish, and no anti-Semitic attack can change that.
That is who we are. And so they can hate us for that if they want, but that is who we are.
After the synagogue helped Tilko and her family settle in Northern Virginia, Lederer says Muslims from a local mosque were introduced to the refugee family. And after the Pittsburgh shooting, members of that same mosque came to a vigil here at Temple Road of Shalom to stand with Jews against anti-Semitism. To the volunteers, that gesture was a blessing brought forth by this congregation's effort to love the stranger as yourself. Jerome Sokolowski, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio and 819 right now. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Thanks for joining me today. 2018 saw forest fires, hurricanes, and tsunamis. These natural disasters are confirming what a series of scientific reports predicted this year.
The current change that we're experiencing is particularly alarming. In the history of human civilization, the climate has never changed this rapidly.
Coming up in 20 minutes, we'll have a closer look at the predictions.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. This week on Beta, we catch up with the man behind the Manitowoc Minute, Charlie Behrens.
I come from like an improv background, and the number one rule in improv is don't think. So I just try to do what I feel like, and I'm wrong a lot of the times. But if you're wrong often enough, you know, you're right sometimes.
The Wisconsin YouTube star joins us Saturday at 9 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering a range of snowshoes and equipment for adults and children to enjoy the serene beauty of a Wisconsin winter. 220 West Broadway in Monona, or on the web at rutabaga.com.
WGTD is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR, a cultural asset and a community resource. WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College, with additional financial support from the Wisconsin Public Radio Association and local underwriters whose customers value public radio.
In weather for today, I don't even know what protective clothing to tell you to use, because you're probably going to need all of it at some point. The northern quarter of the state is under a winter weather advisory. Rain in the south, sometimes heavy, a wintry mix expected in the middle of the state, and heavy wet snow for the north, 2 to 8 inches of it are possible today. And we're expecting highs in the upper 30s to the low 40s. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults at home in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Learn more at 1-800-365-4189. From iDrive, maker of Remote PC, providing real-time remote access to PCs, Macs, and servers from anywhere for use when telecommuting or for remote management. Learn more at remotepc.com/NPR. And from Tire Rack, with more than 500 tire models from 22 manufacturers and an online tool for finding tires based on vehicle, needs, budget, and brand. TireRack.com, helping drivers find, deliver, install.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. 2018 was a big year for political nonfiction. Exposés from prominent journalists and tell-alls from former administration officials. Many of them had dramatic titles like Fear, Fire and Fury, and Unhinged. I'm joined now by NPR's senior editor correspondent Ron Elving and political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben. Hey, you guys.
Good
hey,
to be Noelle. With you.
It was a year in which it felt like there was a lot of political nonfiction, but not just that, that everybody was reading it, starting with Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury all the way back in January. Was this year unusual, or did it just seem that way?
I would say it was unusual, and mostly because there are so many people leaving the White House so quickly, so that just within the first 2 years, a record number of people have left from the president's inner circle, from the cabinet, from the advisors at the highest level in the White House, and several of them have written books.
And I would add here, it might be a quantity versus quality thing also. I mean, if you look back, yes, there were some books already out in 2010, 2 years into the Obama administration, talking about analyzing Obama's rise to the presidency. So it's not unusual for books to be out now analyzing a presidency. But the tone of these books, you had books that with these apocalyptic looking covers, you know, Trump against a red background, with titles like Fire and Fury and Fear. And also not only that, but idea books about authoritarianism, books like How Democracies Die, The People Versus Democracy. I mean, the tone was very scary in a lot of these books.
Let's go through some of the highlights. One of the big ones this year was A Higher Loyalty by former FBI Director James Comey. Ron, you reported on that book. You reviewed that book for NPR. What stood out to you?
Some of the comparisons that he makes to the earlier parts of his career when he prosecuted mafia families, and the code of silence that they had, and the sort of generalized family-based criminal enterprise. That's a shocking comparison to make in the spring of 2018. Now, it may not seem quite as shocking at this stage, but at the time that he was using that kind of language, that really stood out.
There were also a significant number of tell-alls from people close to the president. Some former White House staffers published notable books. Ron, which one was your favorite? Which one was the most notable?
Well, Michael Wolff was not really a staffer, but he was really a fly-on-the-wall reporter who was allowed to hang out in the White House inexplicably for a long period of time and write a book. And that really set the tone for the book because it came out fast. He knew exactly what he was doing. He got it out really quickly. So that when Omarosa Manigault, who had also had a brief period on staff in the White House, came out with a similar book, it didn't have nearly the same sort of impact. But I think really the book that made the biggest difference in reporting on the inside of the White House was not written by a White House insider, but by someone to whom many of those insiders had spoken, and that was Bob Woodward.
Tell us about Fear.
Bob Woodward had already had 18 other books, many of which were number one New York Times bestsellers, but the one that everybody remembers is All the President's Men.
Yeah.
That was about Watergate back in the 1970s. People have studied it in school, and he's still doing it in much the same way he was doing then, giving people anonymity, getting people to really download the stuff that they know, and he has apparently done that with most of the important people who have already left the White House, including at least one chief of staff and a strategic advisor and a lot of other people with very high titles. And we don't know for certain who said exactly what, because that's not Bob Woodward's style. He writes the book as though he knows everything, and you have to divine who told him what. But this book has perhaps more impact than any he has written since Watergate, because he takes on the president so directly, and the things that he says about him would really have to be described as a form of indictment.
Mm. Danielle, you reviewed Michelle Obama's memoir, Becoming. There were some things that really stood out to you in that book.
Right. So it's not a book where the point is getting juicy tidbits. This is not a tell-all in the sense of Michelle Obama coming out of the White House and giving you the hot gossip on what everything that was happening in the Obama White House at all. It's about Michelle Obama's life, starting as a child growing up on the South Side of Chicago and going up through adulthood, through her marriage to Barack Obama and beyond.
One thing that I learned from you in an interview that you did on Morning Edition about this book is that the Obamas went to marriage counseling. I had not been aware of that. That was a real jaw-dropper for me.
Yeah, they go to couples counseling. They go through IVF to conceive their two daughters. And it's not that the book is super explicit about all of the troubles they had in their marriage, but you get a sense of this marriage that we all watched in the White House and that a lot of people admired was certainly not without its problems.
Ron, Ken Starr also had a book published this year.
It didn't make a big splash. You pretty much have to explain to people now who Ken Starr was or is. Ken Starr was the president of Baylor most recently, but before that, he also was the prosecutor, the independent counsel, if you will, who went after Bill Clinton in the middle 90s and produced the report that resulted in Clinton's impeachment. Ken Starr has more or less maintained his silence ever since. And now that Hillary Clinton's campaign is over and apparently the Clintons are no longer politically viable, he felt it was okay to come out with his book. It's called Contempt, and that's his way of referring to the way that the Clintons handled many things, including the law, in his view. It could also be a title for his own feelings towards the Clintons, which are extremely hostile, particularly towards Hillary Clinton.
Hmm. Of all the political books you read this year, which one was the best written?
I've been telling my friends that one of the best books I read in 2018 is the first half of Michelle Obama's book, which is not to denigrate the second half exactly,
okay.
But the first half of it, when she is talking about her childhood, when she's talking about growing up, when she's talking about meeting Barack Obama, there are some beautifully written, deeply felt, deeply thought out passages in there about marriage, about growing up, about eventually becoming a mother that absolutely struck me as just gorgeous. Once she gets into the White House with her husband, the shields kind of go up. It becomes a little bit more of a political book. But that first part of the book absolutely had some incredible sections in it.
Fran, what do you think?
Probably the best written book that I've read in the past year is John McCain's last entry in his long series of memoirs. This one's called The Restless Wave. And it was written with Mark Salter, who is a longtime collaborator with John McCain, wrote a number of speeches for him, collaborated with him on his books. And Salter is particularly a poetic writer, more of a literary writer than I suspect the senator would be on his own, and probably more than any of the people who wrote books under their own name this year.
NPR's Ron Elving and Danielle Kurtzleben. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
When Pope Francis was elected, many Catholics hoped he would be a reformer. Now many of those same Catholics are disappointed.
Pope Francis is a typical Latin American bishop when it comes to dealing with sexual abuse. He just has not been forced to deal with it.
I'm Ari Shapiro. We'll look at a rough year for the Pope this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered starting today at 4 here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
The time is 8:29, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. A news update from NPR on the way in just a moment. Then in WPR's newscast, we'll hear about an invasive pest that's making its home in holiday wreaths and other evergreen decorations. Stay with us.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Congress appears no closer to ending a partial shutdown of the federal government. It's now in its sixth day. No votes are expected when the Senate reconvenes today. President Trump wants Congress to approve $5 billion for a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. The House did so before Christmas. Early this morning, President Trump arrived in Washington following an unannounced trip to Iraq. That's where he met for about 3 hours with U.S. troops at an airbase there. California's open-ended retention of DNA samples is facing a legal challenge. Here's NPR's Martin Costi.
If you're arrested on a felony charge in California, the police can take your DNA, along with your fingerprints and mugshot. If you're not convicted, you can ask to have your DNA expunged, but almost nobody ever makes the effort. That leaves the state and federal government with hundreds of thousands of extra DNA records. Jennifer Lynch of the Electronic Frontier Foundation says that puts you at risk of mistaken identity.
The DNA databases are searched every single day by law enforcement agencies across the country. And what we have seen is that people have been arrested for crimes they haven't committed based on DNA evidence.
Her organization is helping to sue California to do what some other states already do, expunge DNA automatically. Martin Costi, NPR News.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. 8:31 now, I'm Melissa Ingalls. The Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection is warning people in Wisconsin about an invasive pest living on wreaths and other evergreen decorations. The agency says an insect known as the elongate hemlock scale has been found around the state. Spokeswoman Donna Gilson says wreaths and evergreen decorations bought at big box stores like Menards, Kmart, and Home Depot should be burned.
Burn them in your fireplace or an outdoor fire pit if you have those things. If you can't do that, then put them in a trash bag and, you know, knot it up at the top. Stick it in your garbage can for your trash collection service to take to the landfill.
The elongate hemlock scale bug is native to Asia. It hitchhiked to Wisconsin from suppliers in North Carolina. State utility regulators have asked the Wisconsin Department of Justice to investigate a waterworks project in Lodi after claiming the city lacked authorization to build it. The Public Service Commission has notified Lodi's city administrator about the request for the investigation into the construction of the $1.8 million booster station built earlier this year. Lodi's utility awarded a construction contract in February and submitted an application to the PSC in March. The State Journal says despite a warning from the PSC that approval was required before construction, the city began building the station in April. Governor Scott Walker has picked a state lawyer who was vying for a judgeship that Walker ultimately gave outgoing Attorney General Brad Schimmel to serve on the bench in Milwaukee. Walker announced Wednesday that he has appointed Paul Dedinsky to replace retiring Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Mary Kuhnmensch. Dedinsky is the chief attorney for the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection and a former Milwaukee County Assistant District Attorney. He was one of 13 applicants for an open judgeship in Waukesha County, whom Walker passed over on his way to handing the job to Schimmel in November. In WPR weather, the northern quarter of the state is under a winter weather advisory. It'll be windy today, rain in the south, sometimes heavy, a wintry mix expected in the middle of the state, and wet, heavy snow for the north. There might be 2 to 8 inches of it, highs in the upper 30s to low 40s. Tomorrow, the wintry mix changes to all snow, 1 to 2 inches possible in some areas, highs in the 30s and 40s, dropping through the day.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Babbel, a European-made language learning program. Babbel teaches practical conversation in Italian, Russian, Swedish, and other languages. Available in the App Store or online at babbel.com. And from Atlassian, a collaboration software company powering teams around the world, committed to providing the tools and practices to help teams plan, track, build, and work better together. More at Atlassian.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green. This is what the past week has sounded like across the northeast African country of Sudan. Protesters have been on the streets by the thousands, demanding the ouster of an almost three-decade-old regime. And the government has responded with violence. Human rights groups say at least 37 people have been killed. NPR's Eder Peralta has been following this story from his post in Nairobi. Hi, Eder.
Hey, David.
So let's start with why people are in the streets in Sudan. This has to do with food, right?
It does. It started over the price of bread. The government decided to end subsidies, and the price of bread tripled overnight. But this really speaks to the huge economic problems faced by Sudan. This is a country that is still reeling from the loss of most of its oil revenue when South Sudan became independent. So the country has seen inflation go through the roof. People can't get cash. They make hours worth of lines for $20, and then they get to the stores and the shelves are bare. But look, today I was talking to Wael, who's a protester in the capital, Khartoum, who only wanted his first name used because he's afraid of the government. And here's what he told me.
It's not about economics. It's about they are not going to improve the country. I am 25 years old. I cannot see my future here inside this country.
So life is hard, is what he's saying, but he feels like the government does have the resources and they're just misusing it. They're looking out for themselves, he says. So President Omar al-Bashir has to go.
I just listened to that. I mean, it's a young voice we have heard from so many countries in the world, someone demanding more of their government. And you have Omar al-Bashir in power for, as we said, some 30 years, a strong man. I mean, could this be the end of his rule there?
Let me play you something that will explain a lot. So that's what people across Sudan are chanting, and it translates roughly to the people demand the fall of the regime. And if you remember, that was a hugely popular chant during the Arab Spring.
Sure.
And the Sudanese, they took to the streets back then too. And since 2011, people have taken to the streets, and every single time the security forces have managed to tamp these protests down. Analysts I've spoken to say this is a bit different. There's a lot more people on the streets, and this seems like an emboldened protest movement. Across the country, we've seen reports that protesters have attacked government buildings. And one more thing that's good to remember is that popular protest movements have brought down two governments in Sudan, once in 1964 and again in 1985.
But Eder, besides sending police out on the streets and causing people to die and be injured, has the government actually said anything about trying to improve people's lives?
So President Omar al-Bashir delivered a speech a few days ago, but he blamed everyone else. He said that the protests were part of agents, mercenaries, and infiltrators who are just trying to exploit these economic hardships. We've also seen some reports that the troops who have been sent to deal with protesters have instead sided with them. So that's something really important to watch. But the military has officially issued a statement that they are 100% with President al-Bashir.
Eder, thanks a lot.
Thank you, David.
That's NPR's Eder Peralta in Nairobi.
All right, now a story about the science and the politics of climate change. The planet has been warming for decades. 2018 is on track to be one of the hottest years on record. This year, we also saw a bunch of new and more precise predictions from scientists about what climate change is doing to the weather. The Trump administration questions that science. NPR's Christopher Joyce has the story.
So are we stuck with climate change? You could ask the president, as reporters from Axios on HBO did.
Is there climate change? Yeah. Will it go back like this? I mean, will it change back? Probably. That's what I think.
You could ask a senator about climate change, as a reporter did to Republican Ted Cruz from Texas when he was campaigning this fall.
Well, listen, of course the climate is changing. The climate has been changing from the dawn of time. The climate will change as long as we have a planet Earth.
Or you could ask actual climate scientists what they think, like Martin Herling, who was attending the annual meeting of the American Geophysical Union in December.
We're not seeing cycles. We're not seeing things that are going to revert back.
What about that idea that the climate is always changing? Here's climate scientist Stephanie Herring.
The current change that we're experiencing now is particularly alarming, and that is because in the history of human civilization, the climate has never changed this rapidly.
Herling and Herring work for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It was a big year for NOAA and other federal agencies that do science. The government issued a national climate assessment. It said climate change is real, humans are causing it, and it's worse than ever. Earlier this year, the highly regarded Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change came to a similar conclusion. If the Earth warms up another half a degree Fahrenheit, which is very likely, the world's weather will change drastically. In fact, it's already changing. There was yet another study about extreme weather in 2017. Lots of huge rainstorms around the world, for example, and some very wet hurricanes. Martin Herling says it's all about warmer oceans.
To have more water vapor in the air simply delivering heavier rain when it rains. The physics of what's driving heavier rains, even when it's not a hurricane, are virtually the same in many locations.
The physics isn't complicated. Just heat water in a pot on your stove and watch as it evaporates and rises. It will come back down again. Just ask people who lived through hurricanes in Houston, Florida, or Puerto Rico. The last 2 years have seen abnormally strong hurricane seasons in the Atlantic. The extreme weather report comes annually from the American Meteorological Society. Scientists, again, not politicians. It's all about so-called attribution science, determining when a big storm or fire or heat wave is normal or pumped up by a warmer climate. Herling says the science has improved, and it's revealing just what a warmer world means.
With 7 years of these reports, we're seeing more and more evidence building that heat waves are not only happening more often. Their magnitudes is off the charts.
Scientists have also attributed bigger fires to climate change. Physics again. Hotter, drier air turns vegetation into tinder. The stronger link between climate and weather makes it harder to question that the climate is changing, and it has people worried that they may be held liable if they don't plan for that. Attorney Lindeen Patton's clients, for example, people who build things.
You need to go in as a practicing architect or engineer and plan for a different environment, especially for long-lived assets.
Things like
roads, buildings, homes. That's where this type of information that attribution science is generating is informing decision-taking.
So that you won't get sued for failing to build for a warmer world. Patton, who's with the firm Earth and Water Law Group, is also getting calls about climate liability from another group of worried people, politicians. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, right now 8:42. Coming up, in a restaurant world dominated by men, Chef Dominique Krenn recently became the first female chef in the U.S. awarded 3 Michelin stars. She says it's, quote, showing young girls you can achieve a lot in your life. In 9 minutes, Krenn talks about trying to impact other women in the field.
Wisconsin Public Radio Travel has 3 adventures planned for the second half of 2019. In July, we're sponsoring a holiday vacations trip to Alaska and the Inside Passage by ship, rail, and motor coach. We team again with Holiday Vacations in September for a vacation in Italy. In October, we head to South America with Fox World Travel to explore the vineyards of Argentina and Chile. Details on all 3 trips can be found at wpr.org/travel.
Support for WPR comes from 54,000 members who provide the largest portion of WPR's income. They help us bring you familiar voices and new discoveries each time you tune in. Learn more about Wisconsin Public Radio at WPR.org.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Glass All Naturals of Burlington. Family-owned and operated, Glass offers a variety of cheese spreads and sauces. Winter Harbor Market is open at the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha, Saturdays from 10 until 2.
Morning edition on WPR. Here are some of the headlines that we're following this morning. Saudi Arabia's King Salman has issued a wide-ranging overhaul of top government posts, including naming a new foreign minister. This follows international fallout from the killing of Saudi writer Jamal Khashoggi nearly 3 months ago. Back from a 29-hour trip to visit U.S. troops in Iraq, President Donald Trump is returning his attention to the ongoing partial U.S. government shutdown. In a morning tweet, Trump says, quote, "We desperately need a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border, funding for which has been a flashpoint between the White House and Congress ever since Trump took office." There's more news from NPR and WPR on our website. Go to WPR.org. In weather for today, the northern quarter of the state is under a winter weather advisory. Rain in the south, a wintry mix in the middle of the state, wet heavy snow for the north, possibly 2 to 8 inches of it, and we'll have highs in the upper 30s to the low 40s today. It's 8:45.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features, presenting Mary, Queen of Scots. A rebellious young queen stops at nothing to reclaim her throne. Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie star as warring queens, now playing in theaters everywhere. And from Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Office locations are at visitingangels.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. Walk around the campus of the University of Southern Indiana, and you may notice a very small house. It's part of an experiment to create houses of 600 square feet that can be built in days. These little homes could offer housing alternatives for elderly people. Isaiah Seibert of member station WNIN in Evansville has the story.
The small 600-square-foot modular house is called Minka. The name is derived from a simple and functional style of Japanese home. Bill Thomas is a geriatrician by training, but today he's overseeing the construction of one of the first Minka prototypes on this university campus in southwestern Indiana, with his elderly patients in mind.
This is the Minka revolution.
Workers hammer away, putting the final touches on the foundation. No one will live in this prototype house. It's being built for research. But housing officials from Loveland, Colorado, a town about 50 miles north of Denver, have different plans for Minka houses.
I'm really interested in observing the actual construction method because it is different than what we are used to.
Darcy McClure is director of real estate development with the Loveland Housing Authority. Its projects are normally stick-built with everything constructed on site, but Minka houses are modular. Parts of the house, like floor boxes and wall panels, are built in a factory and shipped to the site. As for construction, think Legos. Next summer, Loveland will break ground on its own Minka houses. They're initially building 9 to house senior citizens.
The fact they want to do this type of housing and community build is awesome. It's brilliant because that's the need that's out there right now.
Valerie Jurek Henry is a North Carolina-based housing consultant who works with builders to construct accessible homes and is a big fan of modular houses. While the idea of modular homes for the elderly isn't unique, its use for a whole community is intriguing. Each house costs about $75,000 to build, and they're constructed quickly, very quickly. While stick-built homes can take months to construct, you can build a Minka house in just a few days. Jurek Henry thinks this project can help raise awareness about alternatives to the single-family home. She notes a severe lack of knowledge about housing options in this country. People often choose houses for themselves based on what they've grown up in. But what people know and what people actually need can be very different. And that's part of the idea behind a Minka house.
If you have a small, high-tech, compact, livable house, and you have good neighbors close by, you can maintain your independence for a lot longer than if you're living alone in a house at the end of a cul-de-sac.
Minka developer Bill Thomas sees them as an alternative to assisted living or nursing homes for millions of seniors. Thomas says an accessible house that works for the elderly can also be perfect for a young 20-something. And that's why one of the first is on a university campus. The house has already caught the attention of students who gawk at the construction as they walk by. Thomas is in talks with the university about building a whole community of these Minka houses near campus. He wants to create a small neighborhood, students who want an alternative to dorm life living next door to elderly people in the surrounding community. His goal is to provide accessible homes to seniors while bringing generations closer together, one tiny house at a time. For NPR News, I'm Isaiah Seibert in Evansville, Indiana.
We appreciate you listening to Morning Edition. And if you want to get in touch with us, we're all on Twitter. You can find me at Noel King. David Green is at NPR Green. Rachel Martin is at Rachel NPR. And Steve Inskeep is at NPR Inskeep. And if you want to find out more about the rest of our team, head over to npr.org/morningedition and click on the staff tab. This is NPR News.
Good morning. 10 minutes before 9 now, and thanks for tuning in to Wisconsin Public Radio today. Morning Edition is just about done for the morning, just about 10 minutes left. But stay with us. Stephanie Elkins will be in just after 9 with classical music for you. Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun begins the music. A flute concerto by C.P.E. Bach, also in the first hour. And later, various pieces about birds by Respighi, Handel, and Delius. That's all coming up.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lakelawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lakelawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakelawnResort.com.
It's winding through a holiday scene with poinsettias and fresh evergreens. WPR is pleased to promote family-friendly events. For more information, go to WPR.org/events.
Celebrate the end of 2018 and ring in the new year with WPR. We have some great specials coming up, including Sunday's edition of Simply Folk that features music that celebrates the passing of time and the hope for a bright future, including songs by Sarah Watkins, the Waylon Jennies, Lou and Peter Berryman, and the Pines. And on January 1st, 2019, the Vienna Philharmonic presents its annual New Year's celebration. You can find out more about our specials at wpr.org/holiday. A winter weather advisory for the northern quarter of the state, rain in the south, a wintry mix in the middle of the state, wet heavy snow for the north, possibly 2 to 8 inches of it, and we'll have highs in the upper 30s to the low 40s today.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green. I was on assignment in San Francisco recently, and it involved some food tasting.
So this is Chef Kren's brioche, served a little bit of cultured butter and sea salt. It's her grandmother's recipe. What's amazing about the brioche is it's actually the one unifying item across all three restaurants, so Petit Kren, Bar Kren, and Atelier Kren.
All of those restaurants are owned by Dominique Kren, who wasn't surprised at all when I told her how good that bread was.
I love brioche. When it's like warm and it's buttery and it's delicious and it's so luxurious, and I will say luxurious, that you feel so connected to the person that make the bread.
I was chatting with the French-born chef shortly after she got some news. Her restaurant, Atelier Kren, was given 3 stars by the Michelin Guide. That is seen by some as the highest honor in the culinary world. And what's more, of all the chefs in the U.S. to get 3 stars from Michelin, Dominique Kren is the first woman.
We were not seeking it. We don't seek those things. It's what we do with it that matters, you know? Doesn't mean that we are better than others.
But she does think this gives her a better platform now to inspire women in an industry largely dominated by men. Dominique Kren says she has seen slow progress, making kitchens more diverse and building respect for women there. She's made her own way up in the San Francisco restaurant scene since moving here from France in her 20s.
When I start to work in a kitchen, there's not a lot of women that were working, and I didn't try to pay attention to that, but I knew there was something that I had to work harder than others. And I was a bit picked on sometime, but I'm a very strong person. Nobody touched me.
I would cut them. Did you face people who thought you were moving quickly because you're a woman?
Yeah. There's one guy. I remember him. I'm not going to say his name. He was very short. I called him Napoleon.
He's like a fellow cook in the...
Yeah.
What did you tell him?
You know, I've never been aggressive to anyone, but I looked at him in his eyes and I said, listen, you can think anything of me, but what I'm going to show you is what I can do. And if you're not happy, then... I don't really care. I think the chef is happy, so that's what drives me here. I need to please my chef, but I'm also pleasing myself, and that's it. You have to talk like this. You can't, like, engage in, like, violence. So I think they want you to, like, fight. A fight with words.
Given all of this work you've been doing and trying to use this platform, I want to read you something that I know you've heard before and that just, it just caught my eye. I had to reread it a few times. It was Michael Bauer, who's the longtime restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. He said about you, she has been successful because she does have talent and she has worked hard, but let's be honest, also because she has enormous charisma, she's beautiful, and has that French accent.
Yeah. What
did you think about that?
I didn't like it. But I have to tell you that Monsieur Bauer came to me and he told me that what was said in the newspaper was taken out of context. And I did listen to him. And what I realized at that moment, which I think he shouldn't have never said that, I said, you know, I think sometimes you have to be very careful when you use the word as a journalist, because you, first of all, saying that about me, it's a little bit degrading. Beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, but that should not be a factor on anything. And yes, I mean, charisma, what is charisma? It's like, I'm trying to be genuine every time I speak or I'm out there. And maybe you call it charisma, but this is who I am.
Because if you read that, I mean, he also said about you, she cooks the way men are cooking.
Well, that was not right either, yes.
Did he explain what was taken out of context?
Well, I think what he was trying to say is, you know, I mean, the feel that I'm in and also the style of the restaurant that I'm doing, especially with Atelier Crane, is a little bit different than a casual restaurant. And he was... Perhaps he wanted this to be a compliment. But I'm not saying what he said was right. I'm just trying to, like, be not aggressive about it. Like, I think what I want to say from this is that words matters. And the consequences can be hurtful to others.
The fact that we're even talking about this, like,
it's
those
crazy
words, and that, yeah, what does that say about
that we have
this
a lot
industry,
of work to
this
be done.
Moment?
We still have a lot of work to be done.
And your platform in this moment, like the Me Too movement and a lot of things that women have been through, do you feel like whatever role you can play has become even more important?
Absolutely. You know, I think, I mean, I am just a little fish in the sea, you know. But I do understand that everything that I do could have a little impact. I mean, I had few men chefs that had sent me emails and they have said to me, you know, we have never met, but I have to tell you that I'm not proud about the way that I've been treating people, not just women, but a lot of people in my life. And you have inspired me to be a better person. I hope you can give me some advice.
These are male chefs who said, who can I write in my industry who might give me some advice? And
yeah, that's powerful. I truly believe that some people go through life and they've been taught not the right way, but I can't judge them.
I mean, there have been chefs in this country who have been accused of having a culture of harassment in their kitchens, and women who have worked for them who have said they've been abused. And I just wonder, like, when those accusations come out, I mean, you seem to have a level of patience and an open door. I mean, there's some people who say, get that guy out of the industry. Like, don't go to his restaurant.
Not everyone. Yeah. So some I will not give them the pass. I'm giving the pass to people that haven't, you know, done anything violent, especially sexual violence. They have no place to be in an industry where you're supposed to bring people together.
So who gets the second chance? Who do you decide?
For me, it's people that perhaps that work in that environment and understand that they were perhaps follower, but they realized they should have speak up. Because when you look at the world, we are all complicit.
Dominique Crenn is chef owner of Atelier Crenn and other restaurants in San Francisco. She recently got 3 stars from the prestigious Michelin Guide. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King.
You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. To follow developments throughout the day, visit WPR.org. There you can check out statewide reports from WPR's award-winning news team, plus national and global headlines from NPR. It's a minute before 9 now. Headlines and music on the way.
Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, dedicated to offering a comprehensive academic program with a 9-to-1 student-to-professor ratio and a commitment to personalized education. Lawrence.edu.
Support for WGTD comes from Gateway Technical College. There are more jobs and opportunities out there than there are people to fill them. Gateway will prepare you for the growing job market. Life is big. Be prepared. Get started at gtc.edu.
You're listening to WGTD.